Okay. And I'll grab the computer keyboard. Your slides, your first slide is on, Emerging Scientific Mind and Brain. And so while you talk, you instruct me to change slides, and we proceed. So you're on.
That sounds wonderful. Well, I want to say hi to all of you, and
hello.
In particular, thanks to Jan and other members of the Learning Development Institute, not only for organizing this, but for allowing me to participate remotely. I'm really sorry I can't be there to meet you all face-to-face, but I really appreciate the chance to at least speak with you this way. As that first slide said, I want to try and lay some themes that may be useful to everybody throughout the meeting. The first of them is to think of not only mind, but brain. I'll try and make you an argument that it's helpful to all of us to think of what we're doing as working with the brain. I also would like to suggest that the notion of building the scientific mind might be modified slightly to call it facilitating emergence of the scientific mind, and I'll try and show why I think that's important. Emergence for me represents exploration, creation, and what I will call storytelling and revision. It also represents skepticism, and I'll try and make it clear where each of those comes in. I hope the slides are reasonably clear. There is a URL on the bottom of them, and hopefully Jan will hand that out so that people can get to this talk. It's located on our website, Serendip, and I'd like you to think of that also as a possibility in thinking about how to facilitate the emergence of scientific mind brain. Can you give me the next slide, Jan?
It's on.
Okay. What I want to do is to try and get us to think in a very broad context about this notion of emergence. And the very broad context is, I guess, the broadest possible, the history of the universe. The slide begins with the Big Bang over on the left, something like 10 or 15 billion years ago. And it imagines that as a result of that Big Bang, there was an extended process of exploration of possible forms of matter. On the left side below, it shows a part of that exploration, what I call the active inanimate, quarks bouncing around and forming atoms, atoms bouncing around and forming molecules, molecules bouncing around and forming masses. I regard all of that as the beginnings of active exploration. About 4 to 5 billion years ago, that exploration led to a new kind of matter, organized matter, and that organized matter were living things. I refer to them here as model builders because they have an internal organization that allows them to make predictions about their surroundings, and they have a significant stability because of that ability to make predictions about their surroundings. I want to distinguish model builders, an important level of this exploratory emergence process, which includes prokaryotic cells, eukaryotic cells, multicellular organisms, and the like, from storytellers. And I want to argue that that's actually a quite late development in the exploratory process. Storytellers are those organisms that have the capability to use models in order to create things that would not otherwise have come into existence. Those storytellers appeared, evolved from this exploratory process. Oh, nobody knows exactly when, but sometime in the last several million years. And they include us, of course, and they include phenomena like consciousness, agency, and free will. And what I want to do then now is to focus a little bit on this notion of model builders and storytellers and how it can help us think about the emergence of the scientific mind. Can you go to the next slide, please, Jan?
It's on.
What we're talking about here is a very long and continuing process of exploration of possible forms of organization. scientific mind, we want to be thinking about how to move with the flow of this exploratory process and make use of it. Living organisms added internal organization capable of representing aspects of their surroundings and anticipating internal change. Some living organisms, the storytellers, added the further capability of generating alternate conceptions of themselves and their surroundings. With this came purpose, intent, meaning, and the potential of bringing into existence forms of organization that would not otherwise have occurred, i.e. that exist only because of planning and intention. Can you give me the next slide, John?
You have it.
This is my quick summary of everything I know about the brain, and I show it to you to emphasize that the human brain is a structure with both model building and storytelling capacity. The figure on the left is a section of a sectioned human brain. You're looking at it from the midline, and below it is the blown-up picture of a frog brain, and though I can't point to it from this distance, everything in the frog brain is actually in the human brain, and it is what I call module one of the human brain. It's surrounded in humans by module two, the wrinkled surface that we normally think of when we think of a brain. That's the neocortex. It is module one which represents the model-based processing which we share with all other organisms. It is largely unconscious. It has important elements of unpredictability and creativity. It's the part of our brain that we use to do almost all day-to-day tasks and to learn most effectively. Module two is what gives us the capacity to be conscious. It gives us the capacity to experience things. And most importantly, it gives us the ideal of meaning and intention. It gives us the ability to tell stories. Can you give me the next slide?
It's there.
Just to summarize, most of human dealing with the outside world is done by module one, the part we share with all other vertebrates. It involves basic exploration, and it should be used and built on. Module two provides the ability to be aware of, to reflect on, to be skeptical, and to create new things that depend on such reflections and skepticisms. It is based on input from module one that module two creates what I want to call stories, pictures, ideas, ways of making sense of things that constitute human experience and culture. Module two, in turn, influences module one and via module one, the world outside, other storytellers, other model builders, and the inanimate as well. It's a curious but important architectural feature of the arrangement that module two can only receive input from and only act via module one. Stories, including such things as reality, meaning, ideals, and science itself, provide a significant expansion of exploratory capability, but should always be understood as challengeable creations of the brain rather than definitive descriptions of anything that transcends the brain. Can you give me the next slide, please?
Yep.
I want to just give you a quick taste of this difference between model-based processing and stories. And so if you look at the figure on the left, you will see arrows pointing in some direction. And if you look at it for long enough, you'll realize that they sometimes point in one direction and sometimes in another. There are different stories associated with the same input. On the right, you will see the ability to create things that have never been inputs. This is a figure created by the psychologist Roger Shepherd, but it's very much like figures created by the painter Escher. What it emphasizes, both of these, I hope, is ambiguity and uncertainty are not the ripples of imperfect glass through which the brain tries to perceive reality. They are instead the fundamental reality by which the brain creates all of its paintings. My point is, without the storyteller, there is no such thing as ambiguity or uncertainty. And in the absence of ambiguity and uncertainty, there is no capacity to go beyond what the model makers can achieve themselves. should always be thinking about ambiguity, uncertainty, and what it allows us to do. The next slide, please.
Yep.
This is a little more detail about how the bipartite brain is organized. Module 1 actually consists of a very large number of submodules, and I have blown up one of them on the left side of the figure. They each do the same thing for different objectives. The important point here is they begin with a summary of observations, a way of making sense of the world. That leads to an action. It simultaneously leads within the module to an expectation of input resulting from that action. The action goes into the outside world. There is a resulting input. The two are compared. And if the two match, the module says the summary that I'm using still works and has to repeat an action to find out whether it still works. If the two don't match, then the summary needs alteration, and the arrow points up to a change, summary of alterations. I hope this looks familiar to you because it is, as far as I'm concerned, the very essence of the scientific method. And part of my point here is to argue that the scientific method, the continual ongoing exploration, is in fact a fundamental feature of how the brain is organized in Module 1. If we go up to Module 2, we get exactly the same organization, except that now what we're talking about are not summaries of observations, but stories, ways to make sense of very large numbers of observations, having to do with a lot of different specialized modules. Now, the point here is that story, like summary of observations, is permanently and inevitably modifiable. There is no truth here. There is simply the continual development of stories. I think it doesn't show well in the figure, but there is something called the crack. When the story needs alteration, there are always multiple ways to modify it. Those modifications can result from individual variation, from cultural background, as well as from other people's stories. And the argument I want to make for us is the more stories we have, the more effective this recursive process of story development becomes. Can you give me the next slide, Jan?
You're up.
The key points from that last slide, science is actually about continually exploring and getting it less wrong rather than about getting it right. Storytelling, story testing, and story revising is as essential an element of science as is making observations, summarizing those observations, and testing those summaries with further observations. The most important feature of science is skepticism, a continual responsiveness to what doesn't fit, a greater interest in what might be than what is or has been, a willingness to an interest in going on beyond existing observations, summaries, and stories. It's infinitely recursive. All humans have in common the wherewithal to engage in scientific exploration and need only encouragement and support for doing so. Their brains, like yours and mine, are organized to do it. Science is most productive both in and of itself and as a contributor to human culture when it engages effectively with the widest possible range of observations and stories. The unavoidable subjectivity and intersubjectivity of science is a feature rather than a bug, something to be valued and made productive use of rather than to be concerned about. Science has the potential to be what we all collectively need as we evolve into a worldwide community, a nexus point that encourages and supports the evolution of shared human stories of exploration and growth, an evolution in which all human beings are involved and take pride. The last slide, Jan?
Yep.
A reminder of the task that we've set ourselves, building the scientific mind, an assumption behind the advanced colloquium on building the scientific mind, is that the scientific mind provides a key perspective and in essential ways complements various other mindsets. In other words, it's a mindset that everyone should have. I hope that these thoughts in one way or another can contribute to the colloquium and to our ongoing and future work to achieve our shared objective of assuring that everyone has access to the scientific mind-brain. I'm really sorry I can't be there, but there is an online forum that we've created on our Serendip website. The URL for it is given there, and I'd be happy to discuss all of these issues remotely and hear all that you're doing. And there are some references to all of this available at the URL I originally gave. My thanks again to all of you for allowing me to participate this way, and I wish us all the best in our continuing efforts to achieve a spread scientific mind.
Well, Paul, thank you so much. It was great having you here virtually. It's a pity we can't have you here all the time because it was already clear this morning when we were trying to do some primitive mapping of the scientific mind that there are lots of areas where what you just said started interacting with people's thoughts, and I would have been delighted if the discussion could have been continued with you during the 4 days that we are here, but unfortunately it can't. But everyone obviously is encouraged to use the opportunity of the URL that's given here to partake in the discussion on the Serendip website. We all make a printout of these slides here and distribute them to you, so you'll have all that information as well. We may have just, if anyone has a very urgent question, there's 1 minute left of the 20 minutes, we could still use it for that purpose. Anyone who'd like to bring up a point? Yes, Peter?
Just ask him, he talks as if there is a single mind or brain. How does he deal with the fact that brains are all different and this linkage of Model 1 and Model 2 varies greatly from person to person?
Thank you. It was Peter Eisenberg of Columbia University who said, you talk if there's one single mind, how do you deal with it if you do it from the perspective of different mindsets?
It is absolutely essential feature of the brain that it is indeed different in every person. And I'm glad to have the issue pointed out. It's absolutely essential to understand it. The features of the brain that I describe, that is this recursive collecting of observations, creating of summaries, and then the use of those to make stories, those I believe to be features that are, in fact, as I said, common to every human being. The variation affects how one summarizes. It affects how actively one seeks new observations. It affects how skeptical one is, but not the basic summarizing and storytelling process.
Thank you so much, Paul. I'm afraid we'll have to cut it off here because we're working according to a very tight schedule. The next speaker will be on soon. You and I will be in touch, and thank you once again for your contribution to the colloquium.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Goodbye.